This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Samantha Stone, the CMO of the Marketing Advisory Network. Thank you for joining me, Samantha.
Thank you for having me. This is my favorite way to start the day, talking about product launches and go-to-market.
7 a.m. and off we go. So just to get started, can you tell me a bit about yourself, please, Samantha?
Of course. I run a marketing consulting practice and have been doing that for a little over 4 years now. But prior to that, I worked with technology companies for, oh gosh, I'm going to feel really old saying this, but for about 17 years and specialized in growing businesses that had mature projects by bringing them to new segments or launching new products to market for the first time. So work with a number of companies, some of which you might have recognized, companies like Netezza that did data warehousing, helped launch their marketing efforts and bring that company to market along with Ellen and a lot of fabulous teammates there. Worked at some very large companies like SAP and lots of things in between. And my specialty really is around go-to-market and making sure that we have effective strategy for growing adoption of new technology that we're working. In my consulting practice, I continue to work with technology companies and others, some in the manufacturing space or scientific space, that have complex selling processes and helping them build strategies for making sure that they're driving product adoption, that they're designing products that are going to need an actual market, meet an actual need, as well as helping those organizations seek funding and things like that.
And towards the end of this month, you have a book coming out. So we're recording this at the start of October, and you're publishing towards the end of October. Can you tell me about that, please?
Absolutely. I'm very excited. It's been a labor of love for a long time. In some ways, you can say this book was written over the last 10 years, bits and pieces and outlines, but really the last 5-6 months put a concerted effort to document my approach to going to market. The book is called Unleash Possible. It's really a marketing playbook for people who have complex selling processes. What makes it different than a lot of books that are on the market today is that I've attempted to inspire people, I hope. But more important than that, I've tried to show people how to do the things that I do, how to decide what to bring to market, how to understand your buyers, how to collaborate with sales and product management, and to do it from across a whole bunch of really important disciplines in the marketing organization. So my hope is that this book will help marketers be more efficient, but also will help non-marketers understand how to leverage marketing as a discipline and how to work with their marketing team to be most effective at serving their customers.
You mentioned the term a couple of times, complex selling process. What's that?
Yeah. That's a really good question. I equate it to, there are some very simple selling processes that happen today. So in our consumer life, if I'm going to go buy a pack of gum, I'm probably going to just run to the grocery store, see a bunch and pick something out. That's a very simple buying process. A complex sales process is one where there are multiple people involved in the decision-making process. So in a business-to-business world, often software is one of those things. If I'm buying an accounting system, for example, I have lots of people in the organization who might need to look at, approve, evaluate that solution. There are some things that are in a B2B world that are not complex selling processes. So if I want to buy office pens or paper, that's still a pretty standard, simple process. And there are some consumer processes that are difficult. So when I buy a car, for example, I actually just don't go and buy a car. I talk with my husband. We look at what my future needs might be, who else might be needing to drive it. I have teenage boys, so lots of drivers in my household. So it becomes a more complex process. So when I say that, what I'm really talking about is more than one person involved in the purchase process, a significant financial decision, and that what is significant depends on the business and the context of which we're selling it. But it's not an impulse purchase. It's not something that happens very quickly. It's something that I think about over time.
For startups, is it common that what they're selling ends up in this complex process where you need sign-offs from the buyer across multiple levels, maybe from the developer team, maybe from the CTO, maybe the CEO, CFO, and so on?
It's very possible that I need sign-off for multiple layers. That's a very common, especially as the value and what we charge for a product increases, the more people are going to need sign off. Oftentimes, however, the complexity doesn't necessarily come from budget sign-off. It may, in fact, be a single person can sign the budget, but it comes from wanting to seek multiple people's opinion on it. So I might want people to trial the software in different parts of my team and see what they think of the product. I may want, by the nature of the product, to compare two or three or five different vendors' offerings before I'm willing to make a decision. So the complexity can be financial sign-off, but it can also just be the act of how I make the decision and which other people I have participate in that decisioning process.
For most of the rest of the podcast, we're going to talk about tech companies and mm-hmm. selling and marketing. And one of the things that I've seen, and I think a lot of my colleagues in various companies have seen, is that it can be very hard to, as a tech company, to launch a product and to position it correctly. But that's something that you deal with quite often.
Yeah. Yes, it's one of those things that, candidly, a lot of people do badly, poorly. We make big mistakes. And in fact, the biggest challenge that people make, simply put, is they're afraid to focus. We spend a lot of time when we first germinate an idea and we seek funding or we seek approval to move forward and designing it, convincing the people who are giving us the authority or giving us money so that we can fund the project that the opportunity to invest in this is huge. Lots of people are going to use it. There's so much that we can do. And that is a critical part of getting our idea accepted and adopted. The challenge comes when we actually want to go to market. When we want to let the world know about what we do, we need to narrow our focus quite substantially to our ideal customer profile. In order to build up a base of what I call sort of raving fans or advocates who are going to help us drive adoption outside of our personal family and friends networks who try things because they love us, right? And we all have those. When we want to go beyond that, we really need to understand who we are building for. And the biggest mistake organizations make is we try and build something for the largest audience possible. And in fact, when we do that, we narrow our success. The better approach is to really think about not only what could I do someday, years from now, when I have every bell and whistle that I can think of putting into this product, but what can I do right now to narrow my audience so that I can have incredible success in that particular area. And I need to not only think about what my skills are, but I need to think about what other people are offering solutions to that market. So how can I make sure to understand what the competition is doing so that we can be significantly differentiated from them? Some of the things that we want to think about when we're going off and we're building out these ideal customer profiles is understanding who the initial version of this product or the next version of this product is going to serve, what role in the company is going to benefit most from it. We need to think about things like the industry. What industries are having the biggest pain that I can solve? And once I figure out what vertical markets I want to potentially serve, I need to think about things like, do I need special certifications? Are there people on my small team who actually have expertise in that area? Can they be credible in that space? Does one industry have a larger number of organizations I might be able to target than another? Is there a huge market opportunity for which I have domain expertise, but yet every competitor in the market is focusing on that one? That may not be what I want to choose. And there's a whole bunch of other things that we want to look at, like all aspects of the size of the organization, where those organizations physically reside, how might I know if people are signaling readiness for a product or a service. And so the biggest mistake we make is not taking the time to narrow down the people that we will serve with a new product or the evolution of a product. Sometimes it's we have an existing mature product and we want to bring it to a new market. And the same thing can happen there. And that is a really common fatal flaw in positioning, because we really need to help people understand why we are different and why they should work with us versus anyone else.
What you described there is, to me, quite alien. I'm an engineer, and quite often a lot of small tech companies are made up of mainly engineers. It's highly unlikely I'm going to have those skills. Even if I've read your book and I've listened to this podcast and I've spoken to you, I still can't do what you're talking about.
It's interesting that you said that. So it is a learned skill. It is not a natural skill. And that's really important for us to understand. A lot of technology companies are founded by really smart engineering types. And we have to help people have the ability to think about these types of things. And sometimes, you know, there are individuals for this, it's too foreign. And that's when they need to tap into their world and people they know and seek out people like me or others who can help them do this. But I do believe that with the right discipline, every person can do this. This isn't magic. This is allowing yourself to think small, right? And to think now versus thinking about everything I might do in 10 years down the road. And we have to, because the truth is I've seen an amazing number of really interesting technology ideas die. And they die because the team is unable or unwilling to narrow focus. I'm going through this literally right now with a friend of mine. So there is a friend of mine who's a former CTO. He has teamed with two really smart engineers who have loads of experience, and they've developed this technology that accelerates processing. And I won't go into detail about what it is. It's not really important. And they believe they can change the world and change how big analytic problems are solved. And they may be right. However, they struggle to get funding to move this business forward because they can't articulate specifically who they are going to serve. And so I'm working really hard with them, and it's incredibly uncomfortable because I'm trying to put them in a box right now so that we can dominate and own a very specific market segment. Once we dominate and own that very specific market segment, we can go out and conquer the world, but we simply can't start there. And we see this over and over and over again with individuals who struggle with this, but we have to, and you can solve for it if we allow ourselves the discipline to accept and work towards figuring out this short term. And we just keep telling ourselves, this is our short term ideal customer profile, but we're going to make it work.
If you have managed to identify that that short term goal, and you've narrowed it down, is that then where you prioritize your development?
That's a really good question. And it's actually a challenge to prioritize development, right? People talk a lot about this notion of a minimally viable product. I need to create an MVP to go to market. But there's some wide discrepancy about what belongs in a minimally viable product and how do you prioritize it. And I've been part of too many product planning sessions. And we list out, and I've been guilty, is every capability that we could possibly have. And it's important to do that. You need to understand what the market is demanding. And we think about all the things that our customers over time are going to need. And we start to look at, well, I have a certain amount of time and I have certain skill sets, so I can bite off this set of things and that set of things. I'm going to eliminate others. The problem with that approach is, yes, we need a minimum set of capabilities that are going to get potential buyers to even consider talking to us and thinking about us. And there's some set there, and there's some techniques you can use with qualitative research and survey techniques to help us identify what those are. But the real magic happens. The way you launch a new product to market and you get attention is to focus on your differentiation. Focus on the thing that is going to make you different than the alternative approaches to solving the problem, as opposed to just trying to catch up and do all the things that everybody else is doing. I can get a customer to buy an incomplete product that does something very unique. I cannot get a client to buy or use an incomplete product that does just part of what everybody else does. And that's a really, really important distinction, because if you found a company and a team that can develop every capability all at once, all the time, and be able to do everything, then I want to know who they are, and because they're living in a world that I don't live in. We never can come out with everything we might ever want to do. So we are going to, by default, when introducing something new, have something incomplete. The question is it incomplete and different, or is it just incomplete? So we have to prioritize incomplete and different.
I have worked in companies where we've had incomplete products, and the customers have been very, very willing to buy them, and even accept significant delays in getting the features that they wanted. Are you pigeonholing yourself then a little bit, that if you can somehow keep a customer waiting quite a while for the feature that you're going to build, but no one else is doing it, are you maybe too different from everybody else?
That's a really good question, and it's a really incredibly important to pick differentiation that matters. So I could be the only marketing consultant in the world who gives out blue buttons. I don't give out blue buttons, because really nobody cares about blue buttons. So different alone is not the only criteria. So let me take a moment to share the four components of what we need to consider when we're thinking about differentiation that's actually meaningful. The first is, it does need to be unique. It needs to be something that others don't do. However, that doesn't always mean it's a new capability or a new feature of a product. It could be that we do it in a way that is different, right? That is unique. It could be who we serve that is different than others. So we may be doing very similar things to different companies than other companies, but we're doing it to a different group of people that have been served in the past. The other thing it has to do, and this is, I think, at the heart of what you were describing, is it has to be meaningful to the people we're trying to sell to. It has to have relevant and value in a big and impactful way to the audience we want to serve. It can't just be anything that's different. It actually has to be remarkable, and it has to be something that will attract them and have such an impact on their job and on their business or on their life, depending on how you're serving them, that they are willing to put some things aside. So it can't just be something we like, just something that's cool. Buyers have to care about it. The other two criteria are equally important, but they're a little bit different in their approach. And that is, our differentiation needs to be credible. We need to be able to prove what we're saying is in fact true. People have to trust us that this is in fact a difference. We can't just say what we've built is the fastest way to do something. We actually have to be able to show them it is in fact the fastest way to do something. And in fact, they have to care that fast matters, right? And then the last thing is, it actually has to be durable over time. So I have seen many organizations develop a new capability that's really interesting, that actually does solve a problem that buyers care about in a unique way, but it's easily replicated by other people. And if your solution is easily replicated by other people, and it's important, they will just follow and copy you. The other thing that it has to be is that it has to be relevant over time. So sometimes things that are difficult to do are in fact still not durable. I'll give you an example. There's a lot of social media tools that are on the market today. And one of the things that they struggle with, and that is a challenge for those, is which things they integrate with. So there was a lot of people who spent a lot of time building interesting tools on top of Google+. And at the time, that seemed like a really smart thing to do. People were using Google+, they were leveraging Hangouts, they invested their whole company in being the company that did something on top of Google+. Problem was, the market shifted. Google+ never built the kind of traction that they had hoped they would, and it's effectively not a viable social network at all. And we now you have to look at things like Instagram and Snapchat and all kinds of other tools that have popped up. And so while it was hard to replicate what those companies had done, it wasn't sustainable over time because their buyers had shifted where their focus was going to be. Now, we can't all have crystal balls. We couldn't all know going into that Google Plus was not going to be the magic formula. But we could have predicted at that time that there wasn't going to be a single social network that would dominate. And that if I were going to build a tool on top of something, I would need a tool that would be able to serve multiple mechanisms and serve multiple platforms. And so when we're building that differentiation, we have to have all of those things. It has to be unique. It has to be meaningful. It has to be credible. And perhaps in some ways the hardest, it has to be durable and sustainable over time.
I remember, this is slightly off topic, but I remember reading about General Electric and sort of touching on that durability. They say they love getting into industries that other people can't get into because of the barriers to entry. For example, MRI machines or electric power generators, because it costs billions to get into that field. So there's maybe three or four companies, Pratt & Whitney, a few others, MRI, I think there's Siemens. There isn't much in the way of competition, so they have that durability. But that doesn't apply to most small tech companies, of course.
Yes. Sadly, most of us don't have billions of dollars in our pockets to be able to do that. So here's the reality. In the world that most of us live in the software world or even in hardware, most of us, I've worked for a couple of companies that develop hardware. We're not developing the kind of hardware that requires billions of dollars of investments and will, you know, over time, hopefully get a reward. We're working on things that are moving very quickly and require hundreds of thousand dollars or millions of dollars to invest in and create. And what makes us durable initially may not be the thing that makes us durable in a year from now or 4 years from now. So durability is relative to the market we're in. And we cannot assume that people won't catch up to us. But we have to try and go in where there is at least a runway that we can look forward to that's reasonable and say, for the next year, it's going to be really hard for someone to copy what we're doing or for the market to shift so dramatically that it won't matter anymore. And if we can think about it in at least that time frame, then we have a good model for reality in the practical world that we live in. And the truth is, it's actually getting easier and easier for people to get started. I think buyers are increasingly willing to try things that are incomplete. And I remember, you know, 10 years ago, certainly 15 years ago, when we wanted to release an enterprise software product, we really had to be buttoned up. There were not a lot of gaps that we could afford to have in our product before, and people just wouldn't be willing to try them. And there are lots and lots and lots of proof points today where people are much more willing to bring in an incomplete product and solve a very specific problem, even if it doesn't solve all of their problems. And we have the opportunity to take advantage of that and then to grow our businesses when we get really good at one segment of that market.
We've been talking quite a bit about marketing and maybe sales to some degree, but a lot of companies, when they start off, they will not have that role because, well, they've got nothing. They've got two or three friends who are engineers and maybe they grow a little bit. So when do you decide to hire sales or marketing? And are they the same or do you need two people?
That's an excellent question and a really, really important one. I'll start first by saying that sales and marketing are two different disciplines. And so I believe that you need two different kinds of people to provide the expertise you need to do positioning really well, competitive analysis really well, development of content, things like your website. And that if your salesperson is trying to do all that, they're not doing what they need to be, which is out evangelizing your product or service and describing that. So I do think you need different resources. They don't always need to be full-time people. In particular, marketing is an area early in your business that is well suited to be outsourced. There's lots of people like myself and lots of tools that are on the market that at the early days, you may not need a full-time person depending on your business and your competitive environment and a whole bunch of other factors. But you do need somebody different than your salesperson. Now, having said that, it's a really good question about who should be doing sales and when. So the reality is every business needs a sort of quote salesperson from the very, very beginning. We need someone who's going to champion our idea and interact with buyers to facilitate us learning and making sure we're building something that is accurate. Typically, that salesperson is actually not a salesperson in the early days. They may be your CEO. They may be one of the founders. There'll be someone who has really strong communication skills, is really good at listening, is really good at evangelizing and building up excitement about what we're doing. And that excitement is to secure money. It's to secure your early adopters or your beta customers. It's to recruit the other couple engineers you may need, right? It's to pull in all the favors that we know. And so you need a person who has those skills from the very, very beginning. The challenge is a lot of organizations take the approach of, I have something I've developed. I'm going to go out and sell it. So I'm going to ramp up my sales efforts pretty quickly. And instead of just having the founder or sales-like person on the team be responsible for evangelism, I'm going to quickly hire 1, 2, 3, sometimes more salespeople full-time. And I'm going to let them go out and find us the early customers. And then once we've done that, we'll figure out where our product is a good fit and we'll aim it at that market moving forward. So that's what I sort of call the ready, sell, aim approach. I build something, I go point a bunch of people towards selling it, and then I aim my market efforts. And that approach is fundamentally flawed for lots of reasons, but two in particular important reasons. One is the early sales that you get in that model may not actually be indicative of what your long-term market viability is. Because what we do in those early stages is we reach out to our personal networks and we get introductions and we bring on board anybody who's willing to have a conversation and to take this. We may be bringing on board customers who have nothing to do with the people who are really in the long term, who don't know us and don't love us, be willing to buy and use our product and service. So I'm not saying don't go out to your networks. We all do. That's how we start our businesses. It's the right thing to do. But don't use that to define your customer profile because it can be extremely misleading. The other thing that's a challenge is that salespeople cost a lot of money. And we invest in the infrastructure to bring those people on board, and we don't yet understand who they should be going after, and we don't understand where it's going to stick. So they spend and waste a lot of time talking to the wrong people, and they're wildly inefficient in their approach because we don't have the insights to point them in the right direction. So my belief is instead of taking this approach where I build something, I build up some sales effort, and then I try and figure out how to aim, we start the process very, very much upfront by doing that market analysis. And whether it's a marketing person or someone who has figured out how to replicate some of the skills of a marketing person isn't as important as we need to aim towards the ideal customer profile from the beginning. We need to build the solution that's going to solve the problem for that particular audience. And then once we have validated that we are correct, that we know our ideal customer profile, then we go build our sales team. Then we go bring people on board because now we can point them efficiently towards the right people with the messages we know are going to resonate. And now we're scaling early adoption of our product. We're not just starting from scratch. How long that takes is going to vary by each business. I can't tell you 90 days in, you should hire salespeople, or a year in. There's a whole bunch of factors that will help us determine what is that moment in time. But what I can tell you for certain is that I see many organizations try and bring on salespeople full time and build up a sales force well before they are ready. And they end up in a position where they run out of money quickly. They feel like they have to do what we all call a pivot, right? People talk about this. Oh, I'm going to pivot my business. I'm going to redirect our efforts. And we congratulate ourselves for being lean and agile. The truth of that is we're not being lean and agile. We didn't do our homework up front. We didn't take the time to do it right in the first place. So we are forcing ourselves to pivot. And that is a dangerous situation to put ourselves in when we have limited capital, when we have limited resources to go after. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yeah. So let's say you have gotten to the point where you have some sales and you're hiring a salesperson or whatever it happens to be. You've said that marketing is distinct from sales. So when do we need marketing? And then is marketing what pushes our product forward, or how does it come into it?
I believe that you need marketing actually from the very, very beginning.
So before sales.
So before sales.
Okay.
And the reason I believe that you need marketing up front, and again, it doesn't have to be a marketing person, but you need someone responsible for the steps and the tasks that need to happen. Oftentimes when we think of marketing, we think of advertising and we think of public relations, and we think of things like our website and press releases and email communications. And that is a piece of marketing, and that is going to follow sales. But there's an equally important strategic component of the marketing that must happen much earlier. And that strategic component of marketing is doing the analysis of helping to identify who our ideal customer is, testing our messaging and our positioning so that we are learning what words and phrases turn off our buyers, what things attract those buyers, building up that core set of customer case studies and scenarios. Even before you have people in full production, we still have to be maturing those relationships with those early adopters and forming and framing how we're going to talk about what they do and the value that we add there. And there's a whole set of things that marketing can do that will drive adoption of product, even within your very earlier beta customer base. We'll help advise things that you might want to build in the product. What information should we be tracking, for example, about usage in the product that will trigger later marketing communications to help drive greater usage of the product? Do I want to be notified when someone registers for the product for the first time? Do I want to be notified if there's been no activity for 5 days? What are the things that we want to build into the product that are going to let us communicate with customers and help train them and move them towards using the product? What sort of gamification techniques do we want to build in the product to help them want to use it more and to drive it? And these are all the kinds of things that marketing will do to help a product be successful in the market. That is well before we start worrying about spending money on advertising and press relations and all the other things that many of us think of when we think of marketing.
Any final notes before we wrap up this morning, Samantha?
Thank you for having me. It is really fun to talk about going to market. It's one of the biggest challenges we face as organizations when we build innovative solutions to problems. Some of the hard work is thinking of the innovation, and a lot of the hard work is in executing against that and finding people to use and try and adopt. And so hopefully this has given your audience some ideas about how to think about solving that problem. Unleash Possible has been written to help them think about it even more. For those folks who are interested in this topic, who are thinking about launching new products to market or trying to figure out how to grow their current base, unleashpossible.com is a great place for them to go. There's information there about the book, but there's also lots of blog posts and articles and research findings that I have put together there and are readily available for people to take a look at. So I'd encourage people to visit, to learn, ask questions, reach out. I'm always love hearing what people are working on and would welcome the opportunity to get to know your audience better and happy to answer any follow-up questions that this might have spurred for someone.
As you say, Unleash Possible coming out end of October. Thank you very much for your time, Samantha Stone.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
The opening music was a return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Into the Labyrinth by Star Over Blue from the album Space Geist.